Welcome back to Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bardrovics, and joining me today on the program is David Hunter. He has 47 years experience in the markets, and he can be found at Dave H. Contrarian on Twitter. He also writes a newsletter by subscription. How are you today, David?
I'm great, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. We wanted to get an update on how things are progressing in the markets. You're part of a very small camp that thinks the cycle is going to end in a global bust. So let's start by defining what you mean by global bust, as we know that common language and precise terms are important to you.
Yes, they are. I started using the term bust several years ago and said that the cycle would end in a bust. And I've always defined bust as something that can cause the damage equal to a depression, but happen in a much faster time frame. So it's bigger than a recession, kind of time frame of a recession, but something more severe than a recession. And yet not drawn out like a depression like we saw in the 1930s with the Great Depression. So global bust obviously means it's not just U.S.-centric, it's worldwide. And I started talking about this many years ago because of the massive debt buildup we had in the system. So both debt and derivative expansion has been through the roof. And I said the next downturn will turn a normal recession into something I call a bust. So that's kind of where the origins of it began for me. A lot of people use the term bust, and they'll talk about the market went bust today, or they throw around the term bust very loosely, but I am using it in a very specific way.
Absolutely, and that's why I wanted to start by defining that. So considering that we're seeing somewhat of the melt-up, as you call it, where are we in that cycle as you see it?
Obviously we had a rough go of it in March when the virus hit. It looked like we were going to break the cycle and head much lower. The central banks came in a big way. The Fed came in a big way in the United States and kind of stopped that free fall. And I said back then that I felt the cycle was still intact and that we would still see what I had been calling for prior to that swoon, that we would see a melt up into a top, that we were heading for a 38-year secular bull market top, and that it would end in a parabolic melt up into that top. So in March, right near the bottoms, I said at that time I still see 4,000 plus on the S&P, that it could happen by the summer. So begin well before that and peak out maybe as early as the end of the third quarter. So we're in the midst of that. We've had obviously a big run from that March low already, consolidated for the last probably almost 2 months. And it looks like we're poised for the next run, something that I think will be pretty equal to what we have from March to now into a top. So I would not be surprised to see the S&P at somewhere between 42 and 4,500 by the end of the summer, which would be end of September, or certainly by sometime this fall before the election.
As you mentioned derivatives earlier, could you explain to us what role derivatives are going to play in that second phase of the bust?
Sure. Derivatives are another form of leverage. I'm not sure a lot of people think of it that way, but you go back to the mid-1980s and we really didn't have, we had puts and calls. We didn't have a lot of derivatives out there. We've had this huge run-up in derivative exposure. Now it's a lot of it's on the debt side, some of it's on the equity side. But with the advent of ETFs and the huge expansion in credit derivatives, et cetera, we've gone to a point where the notional value of derivatives is quadrillions. And so from very little to quadrillions. And it's a form of leverage on the markets. So if a market goes down, derivatives can exacerbate whatever that move is. When markets go up, it exacerbates moves to the upside because you can, with an option or some form of a derivative, an option or future, whatever, you can actually capture a lot more of a stock or a bond, whatever. So you're able to really leverage up your move. And leverage works in both directions. So just like derivatives are something that will exacerbate moves and exacerbate cycles, so I think we are at a point unlike any other time in history where with quadrillions in notional value of derivatives and $250 trillion in global debt, those are numbers that are just mind-boggling, really not something you can wrap your head around. And all I can say to simplify it is that when we roll over, those derivatives and that debt will exacerbate whatever happens and exacerbate it in a very big way. So that's why I think we can take an ordinary market sell-off or an ordinary recession and turn them into something much bigger.
So as we're talking about the S&P possibly hitting, you know, 42 to 4,500, that's another 1,000 points from where we are. And it seems somewhat unlikely, but explain to us the parabolic nature of this melt-up and how prices could get chased that high.
Sure. You can see it in past markets, certainly the dot-com market in 2000, the Nifty 50 peak back in 1973 are two pretty well-recognized examples of where markets in the end go into a very steep sloping rally where you cover a lot more ground in a lot shorter period of time. So things almost go vertical. And that happens at ends of moves. So another example would be back in the early 90s, the consumer growth stocks, which was the drug companies, the packaged food companies, the Coca-Colas of the world. You know, they were the steady growers. They weren't exciting, but they got driven up because that became popular. They were flat on their back in the early 80s and because of inflation. And when inflation started coming down and the economy went through some changes, that became the darling group, just like the FANG stocks are today. That became the darling group in the markets as we moved through that decade of the 80s into the early 90s. And in the last year of that move, many of those stocks doubled and doubled again. In just a very short time, stocks that had kind of moved up gradually went into vertical parabolic moves. So that happens in markets, it happens in groups, it happens in individual stocks, that towards the end of a major bull market move, things can go vertical. And that's what I expect to happen in the stock market. We're maybe 1,000 to 1,500 points away from a top in the S&P. And you can say how, you know, that seems crazy to say that could happen in the next couple months. But just remember, we came from where we did at the March lows, and we've covered, you know, over 1,000 points there. And that was really covered between March 23rd and June 6th. So that happened in virtually 2 months. And if you understand, a slope will steepen as it goes into the parabolic. If you covered the first 1,000 points in a couple months, you could cover the next 1,000 in less than a couple months, even a month. So doesn't mean it has to happen, but that is what I see coming, is the likelihood that we see this thing just really get into a steeper slope.
So, David, do you think that's going to be correlated to Congress passing another substantial relief package?
That will help. It's not really news-driven as much as it will be FOMO, fear of missing out, you know, psychologically driven. It will help to have a package from Congress, certainly. I think it's necessary. We're not out of the woods by any means. And I'm pretty sure we will see a package, whether it's today or whether it's a week or two away. You know, Congress will finally figure out a way to compromise and both sides get some of what they want. So that will certainly help. But more than that, if the S&P moves above its highs prior to the March swoon, you know, its all-time highs, the Nasdaq's already moved there, you're going to see people getting on the momentum bandwagon. Don't forget, we've had an awful lot of investors who got bearish in March. That was a scary time. In 3 weeks' time, we saw the biggest decline in the markets ever in history, percentage decline, and that scared a lot of people. And then, obviously, the virus was scary in itself and what it did to the economy and shutting it down. There were lots of uncertainties out there, and an awful lot of investors, both retail investors and professional investors, chose to sit out this rally because they, you know, they were worried about the bad news. And so there's an awful lot of money that did not come back into the market after the March drop. And it's still sitting there worrying about the next shoe dropping. And I think is starting to get nervous that they were wrong or that they're not going to get that opportunity down there again. And if we break out to new highs on the S&P, I think you're going to see some of that money, maybe a lot of that money, come back in step at a time. By definition, almost, markets are most fully invested at the top and least invested at the bottom. It's psychology at work. And also most bullish at the top and most bearish at the bottom. So as we move to that top, you're going to see more people moving away from their bearish stance to a more bullish stance, and obviously as a result, putting more money into the stock market. So that's what I would expect, is it's more, as I say, driven by the tape than it is by any particular news. It will help if, in fact, we're bending the curve again, if some of these southern states like Florida and Texas and Arizona and Georgia begin seeing their cases come back down. I think that will be part of this. Any news on, you know, better prospects for vaccines will help too. But it's really more the tape that will drive the decisions.
So, David, as you're talking about the second shoe to drop, what could trigger the second phase of this bust, and what are the characteristics going to be of that?
Sure. I think basically we have seen the bust. The bust started. That's what March, April, May, June was all about. We got an awful lot of stimulus pumped in from the Fed and from the Treasury to deal with that, and that's going to give us at least a statistically strong rebound. I've called it a V recovery because, you know, you could have a very strong third and fourth quarter. That being said, you still have many parts of the economy closed down or in very limited production. So you look at the hotel industry or the airline industry or the restaurant industry, you know, cruise industry, obviously, and lots of other areas where the consumers not comfortable going out, or a fairly significant percentage of the population is not, you know, it's impacting those businesses, and not to mention they're only allowed to operate at reduced capacity. Obviously, you know, another big industry in our country is the sports industry, and, you know, that has repercussions across lots of different things, you know, so there's no youth sports, so you're not seeing sporting goods stores doing well, et cetera. You know, in a lot of those areas, even with the strong statistical rebound in the third and fourth quarter, you're nowhere near out of the woods. And many of those restaurants and other consumer businesses are not going to open back up or can be sustained by the government's PPP program for just so long. But that can carry you through a short period where you're in trouble, but that can't sustain you. And so as we get through the third quarter and into the fourth, you know, the markets look ahead. So the market will top out well before the economy finishes its rebound. However, the economy itself, let's say we get through two quarters of rebound, I think 2021, you're dealing with all those things coming back at you, you know. Gee, we're not out of the woods with the virus. Winter's coming, and maybe it even worsens again. And you've got just the lack of ability for companies, big and small, to be able to sustain themselves during a period where they have very reduced demand. So I think as we go through this, what I call the second shoe dropping or the second phase of the bust, it will be all about companies not being able to make it. You know, a lot more what I term involuntary debt liquidation, where basically bankruptcies, where companies are going to have to declare because they don't have the revenues to cover their expenses and their debt. And I think that's going to be a big story in 2021, maybe bigger than anything we've ever seen, you know, ever seen in terms of the dollar numbers of that debt liquidation. And again, I always have to remind people, I talk mostly U.S.-centric, but this is a global phenomenon. This will be happening all around the world. So I think you're going to see some As a result of that liquidation cycle, I think you're going to see some major bank failures. I think not so much in the U.S. U.S. banks really depend on how bad it gets here, but our U.S. banks had such a hit in 2008-9 that they were forced to be very vigilant about their balance sheets going forward. And so our banks are, because of 2008-9, the subprime crisis, because of that, our banks are in better shape than most of the world banks. I think Europe is probably where I would say you have the weakest banks and the biggest risk today in the banking industry. But Canada's, you know, was strong in 2008-9. They're nowhere near as strong today. Canadian banks, you know, the Asian banks are going to struggle. So there's plenty of potential around the world for a banking crisis. And we're not immune to that here in the U.S. because you have counterparty risk, et cetera. So there's a lot that I think 2021 could see that we didn't even see in 2008-9, you know, in terms of magnitude and speed of that risk.
Can you define debt liquidation cycle for us?
Sure. What I call a involuntary debt liquidation cycle is basically saying that companies reach a point where it's not their choice to close down. The creditors try to do workouts and things, but you reach a point where it just isn't workable and companies go under. So it's a involuntary debt liquidation cycle. It's just a period of large numbers of companies that are forced into bankruptcy because of their excessive debt. And we went off the rails over the last few decades in terms of private equity and levering up balance sheets. Because, as I said before about debt and derivatives, debt allows you to enhance your earnings, enhance your results during times when things are good. The problem is, as I learned in business school, we all learned in business school, leverage works both ways. It enhances on the way up, and it exacerbates on the way down. So I think it's very sad. Frankly, nobody talks about this. But private equity, which is a fancy term for leverage buyout company, back in the 80s when Mike Milken really drove that industry, you know, it was called an LBO. Now we talk about private equity. Well, it's just taking companies that are public companies private by levering up the balance sheet, exchanging equity for debt, and then restructuring those companies and bringing them back out to market and making lots of money. That's been done successfully by these private equity companies many times. But there's also a lot of companies that didn't make it. Look at the list of retail companies just in the last year, you know, Payless Shoes and Forever 21, et cetera. Companies that were loaded with debt, you know, we just had Men's Warehouse and Joseph A. Banks file today, I think, or at least the rumors that they're going to file. You load these companies up with debt and they have cyclical earnings. And when the earnings don't cover the debt, something happens. It's not good. So that's basically what we're seeing because of this huge use of debt. I think we're in a cycle unlike any cycle. We saw it in 2008-9 to a great degree, but I think we're even much farther beyond that in terms of leverage this time around. And unfortunately, it means we are going to have something unprecedented in terms of the post-World War II era in the economy.
Interesting. So moving forward from that a little bit, let's talk about the dollar. Why are we going to see disinflation coming into next year? And where do you see, let's say, kind of your perspective on the dollar milkshake theory and the demand for dollars around the world?
Yeah, I'm not a dollar milkshake guy. I couldn't even tell you exactly what that means. I know there's a guy out there that has popularized that and pushed that theory. But I'm not sure exactly what that all entails. All I can tell you is that I believe that the dollar and calling for a dollar decline for a long time when many out there were bullish the dollar. In fact, you go back to March at the top of the dollar when it ran up to 104, you had virtually nobody except me out there saying the dollar's going to fall and fall sharply. And I used 85 as my target. That remains my target. So from 104 to 85 sounded crazy 4 months ago. Today we're down in the 92 and change area, so it doesn't look so crazy anymore. And I've got a lot more company on the bearish side now, but I can tell you there was nobody bearish but me back in March, and people thought I was nuts. So the dollar, I think, is going to continue to slide. It'll have it bounces along the way, but it will slide. And part of that is because Europe is probably in a better place right now with the virus than we are. And our interest rates are getting closer to their low rates. You know, there was a wider spread there for a while that helped the dollar. And what you heard back, you know, several months ago that was making everybody so sure the dollar was going to go a lot higher than 104 was that there was this huge dollar shortage around the world as a result of all the dollar-denominated debt, you know, that even foreign companies would find they could sell a lot of debt in dollars and you know, be cheaper than doing it in their own currencies. So as things started getting rocky in the global economy, a lot of those companies were running into problems because interest rates in the U.S. were much higher than around the world at that time, and it was impossible for them to refinance their debt or to fund it, and it was going to lead to some real problems. So people said as they run into more problems, they're going to need more of the dollars, and that a lot of that has been alleviated because the Fed, who was behind the curve for a long time, didn't understand that they were too tight. Everybody was telling them they were too easy. They finally got religion in March and have obviously expanded the balance sheet from less than $4 trillion to $7 trillion on its way to probably $10 trillion this year. And so that has created a lot of dollars around that has helped alleviate the shortage of dollars. So I think that all goes into why the dollar, the Fed's going to continue to print and the dollar's going to continue to go lower here. I do believe if we down around 85, probably bottom out, and you will see another run to higher highs on the dollar beyond that. But for now, it's a weak dollar story, and I think that's what we're going to see through this year.
So after we've talked about all these negative things and everything falling, obviously most of the Palisade Radio listeners know that the precious metals industry seems to be somewhat of a safe haven. So can we get a little bit of your outlook on what all of this means for gold and silver moving forward?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, the gold and silver are obviously in the sweet spot right now. They're, let's step back a second. Gold peaked out in 2011 at something over 1900, and silver back then was over 50, I think, or around 50. And it spent many years consolidating that, dropped sharply in the next couple of years after 2011, and then basically went sideways to down for several more years. So, you know, it was like an 8-year period of drought in gold and silver. And back in 2011, after a decade-long run, you had a big number of gold bugs out there, a huge sponsorship for gold and silver. And then, you know, you can understand that year after year, people were calling for it to finally turn around again and go up again. And after 8 years, a lot of those gold bugs got very discouraged, and probably well before 8 years, and walked away from it and said, I'm not looking at that. It's been a disaster. And so in the last year particularly, you began moving up from that. I mean, gold bottomed out, I can't remember which year it was, but several years ago at 1050, so down from 1900, 1050, ran up to, I can't remember where, but then corrected back down to a higher low. But it spent, again, a lot of time where it'd start to rally, you think, here we go, and then it'd pull back again. And only in the last year has it really consistently started to move, other than March. It got hit really hard in March, and particularly the miners themselves got hit hard in March, and silver got hit very hard in March. But they've come out of that and are now extremely strong. You know, silver got up to 26 the other day and probably will exceed that within the next week or two. And gold is on its way to 2,000 here, and I think ultimately my target for this year is 2,300. So you've made it all the way back in gold to new highs, and I think that's starting to capture a lot more people's attention again. So gold is back in favor, and silver, which I call poor man's gold, is gaining favor because it's behind gold. You know, the gold-silver index got up over 100 and I think all-time highs, indicating that gold was far more highly valued than silver at that time. That's since corrected as silver started to have a catch-up rally here. So I think there's a lot further to go on that and on the downside in terms of the gold-silver ratio. but they're both going to move up strongly here into, I think, into the next, certainly through this quarter and into the next quarter. So I, as I said, I think gold can get up to 2,300 in that rally, and I think silver can get up to something around 35. Then I would guess they sell off, and I'm not sure about the 2,300. That may not even be the high for gold. I'm more comfortable with my 35 target for silver, 35, 36. Gold could run a couple hundred points past 2,300. I don't know. But ultimately, I think they will be hit in the bust with most assets. So when the melt-up's over and the second shoe drops on the bust, you know, I'm very bearish on the stock market. We can talk about that in a minute. But I think most all assets other than maybe treasuries will be hit hard. So gold and silver will be part of that sell-off because of a deflationary bust, because of what happens in 2021. But I used to think that you were going to see a far bigger sell-off in gold and silver to kind of mirror what was going on in the stock market. I now have kind of switched to where I think they sell off to the tune of 25 or 30% maybe, but not 50%, not 60%. And so, you know, you might see gold, if 2,300 is where it tops out, you might see it back at 1,800. If silver tops out at, you know, in the mid-30s, you might see that back to the mid-20s. And then from there, my view on gold and silver is probably as bullish as anybody on the street. I think you'll see this decade gold get up as high as 10,000, maybe higher, and you'll see silver get up as high as 300 and maybe higher. So there's a big, long runway ahead, but there's going to be some volatile sell-offs between now and those runs. But for right now, I mean, there's nothing in a sweeter spot than gold and silver right now.
Excellent. What kind of action are we going to see from the miners? Obviously, if we see a pullback in the spot prices on the metals, what kind of correlations are we going to see with the miners?
Sure. The miners obviously benefit greatly from these metal price moves. You know, I think there's still a good ways to go on the upside in this particular rally. If gold goes 2,300, I think GDX can get up to 55. I think GDXJ, the junior miners, can probably get up near 100. On the silver side, right now, where's SIL now? I can't remember. SILJ is 16 and change, I think. And I think both of those have long runways ahead. I think SIL can get up as high as 75, SILJ probably over 30. So the big moves still ahead. And then obviously in the next big bull cycle after the bust, miners will be huge beneficiaries of the big runs in the metals. I have said before, I think next cycle, not right now, but in the next cycle, which is going to be an inflation cycle, I think the miners will be to the next cycle what the dot-com stocks were to the 90s. I think you will see, you know, if gold can run from 1,800 to 10,000 plus, or silver run from the mid-20s to 300 plus, but imagine what that does to the mining industry. You will see all kinds of investment banking opportunities. You know, a lot of new mining operations are profitable when your prices are up there. Things that can't be mined today because you just can't, you know, the costs are too high to justify it. When you get a price move like that, it opens up a lot more opportunity. So I think you will see a lot of new startups. You'll see a lot of merger and acquisition activity going on. So I think the 2022 to 2028 period could be the most exciting time in the miners that we've seen in many decades.
Excellent. Let's turn a little bit to oil. One of your forecasts is that we could see oil heading back down to $10 a barrel in the second stage of the bust. Is that simply due to a lack of demand when things kind of get shut down again?
Yeah, demand certainly the biggest driver. I mean, we'll still have a supply glut. I think U.S. companies have done a pretty good job of shutting in capacity out of necessity. But when demand's falling like a rock in the second phase of the bust, you're not going to be able to adjust supply to that. So what gives is the price. So yeah, very simply, I think you can get, we're around $40 now, up from negative oil prices a few months ago. So it's come a long way back from, you know, where it was below zero. That was kind of a technical glitch because of a contract, but basically from the single digits, it's come all the way back to 40. I think we probably can get it up to 50, maybe a little higher here in the next few months with the economy opening up. And then I think that second shoe dropping on the bust leads to obviously a lot lower economic activity around the world. And depression level economic activity leads to a huge drop in demand for oil. And so, yeah, you get into a situation where demand far outstrips supply again, and down we go. And I would, I'll use $10 just to retest of that $10 area, which was kind of where it was headed until you had that contract disruption for a few days. So I think you can go back and retest that $10 area. And, you know, that's a 2021 story. And I think, as with the metals, I think the 2022 to 2028, 29 period will be big time for oil. I think oil can probably get up over $300 a barrel in that recovery cycle, because the recovery is going to be, I think, focused on industrial demand. You know, we've had a consumer that has driven the economy for 40 years from, you know, the early 80s till recently. And I think because of what happened in 2000 with people's wealth getting hit, 2008-09 again, and now this time, you know, I think the consumer's going to be in a lot less favorable position going forward. And it's also kind of learned, I think, in this shutdown that maybe shop till you drop isn't what I need to do anymore. Maybe I need to save money. Maybe I don't need all the material things I've been buying. So I think there's going to be a bit of a change in behavior going forward, some of it out of financial necessity and some out of just change in behavior. So what will replace it in terms of the growth vehicle in the next cycle, I think, will be industrial demand. We'll be building new capacity in this country. We'll bring capacity back from China. I think that's going to be a driving force. I think you're going to see, again, not only here but around the globe, huge infrastructure spending, government's fiscal expansion trying to pull us out of this bust. So you'll see military spending. You'll see spending on roads and bridges and airports. And you'll see, in this country certainly, you'll see a lot of money spent on the electric grid, which needs upgrading. So there'll be a lot of places that will stimulate demand for materials as opposed to retail shopping and restaurants and that kind of thing. So I think that means the next cycle is very much going to put upward pressure on commodity prices across the board. So not just metals, not just energy, but also I think ag prices will move up in that cycle aggressively for other reasons, but I think they will fit that commodity cycle. And, you know, you'll see pretty much all commodities across the board going up aggressively over the course of the next decade. You know, first we got to get through this deflationary bust, and that's what this next phase will be, deflationary. It's not disinflation anymore. We've had disinflation, which is inflation at ever lower rates from the early 80s till now. And I think in 2021, we will have the first deflationary downturn that we've had since the 1930s, widespread deflation. So we got to get through that. 2021 will be deflation, and that's not a fun thing. That's not just a reduction in your costs. That's a really tough period. And then we'll begin a new inflation cycle, first very slowly and gradually in 2022, and then it will accelerate to the point where I think by the end of the decade, we'll see inflation maybe up to levels we saw in the early 80s, so back to 15 or 20%. And that's because of all the money printing that will go on.
Well, David, I think that's a great way to wrap things up for today. Any concluding thoughts as we finish up?
Only, I guess, I'd just say to everybody, hold on to your hats. We're in for volatility like we've never seen before. You know, it started out, obviously, March was pretty volatile, and what we've seen on the upside here has been surprisingly fast moves. And I think as we move into the end of this cycle and into the downturn, it's only going to get faster.
Excellent. Just a reminder to follow Dave at Dave H. Contrarian on Twitter, and also like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Thanks very much for your time today, David.
Okay. Thanks, Don. You take care.
You too.
Bye.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.
Think you understand the junior mining sector and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw material. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?